My name is Adam. I'm an alcoholic. And you guys are in luck. You don't have to hear my sponsor talk today. So. The bad news is you're stuck with me instead. So, you know, I like to hear the sound of my own voice, but you may not. I always got nervous when people would bring books up to talk. I was like, oh, God, you know, here he goes. But anyway, I promise not to try to preach at you. As John said, my home group is the Harbor City Speakers Group. It meets Thursday nights in South Baltimore at 8:30, not far from the stadiums, if any of you have been up there. It's a fun meeting. We get a lot of wet drunks, and we get a lot of, you know, people who have been there for 20, 30 years, and it's a nice mix. A lot of young people, a lot of not young people, and you know, a lot of young at heart, and it's kind of where I really got to appreciate the nature of being happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that you could be sober and happy up until I saw people like that, and I thought it was one or the other. You were sober or you were happy. You know, it was a pretty thin line for me as far as I was concerned. And, my sobriety date is June 26th of 2002. And I really had absolutely no intention of staying sober this long in 2002. I had a really good plan, I thought, for 6 months of proving to the people around me that I was not an alcoholic. And therefore, I didn't have to go to these stupid meetings and have to talk to these stupid counselors, and you know, in 6 months I'll have shown you and tell you what to do with it. Now, it says in this book here, this book, Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that they suggest that you try staying sober for a year if you think you may be an alcoholic. And so there I was, trying a half measure right off the bat. I had no idea what I was doing, and I was already, 6 months, yeah, no problem, got it. And what happened to me is I'm sure maybe has happened to some of you guys, is that I got about three or four months into my six-month plan, and I started to realize that maybe drinking wasn't my problem, that maybe there was something deeper, you know, and maybe I was just insane. I didn't know what was wrong with me, you know, because I hadn't drank in 3 or 4 months, and I can't sleep, and I can't eat, and I can't look anybody in the eye, and I can't stand anybody, and I hate my job, and I hate my parents, and I hate my family, and I hate you, and I hate everybody. Damn it, I'm sober, you know, and I'd wake up, and I'm like, oh, I got a wonderful day of sobriety, and, you know, it's just like, pack it up, and get on out there, and, you know, make the world a better place, I guess. I don't know, we were just talking about that, Billy, before. Everything's going down around me, but I'm sober, you know, and you meet these people sometimes, like, Christ's sake, would you just take a drink already? You know, come on. So I, you know, was really pretty spoiled. I mean, I really was a fortunate kid. I had two sisters that loved me a lot and were much older than me, so they kind of got in most of the trouble for me, and they helped me learn how to stay out of as much trouble as I could. And I made it till I guess I was about 19 or 20 years old before I really started getting, like, the legal stuff and the real problems at school. And, you know, I was always just able to slide by. And I guess my first drink was somewhere. Well, it wasn't my first drink, but the first time I really remember feeling the effects of alcohol, I was about 13 years old, maybe 12, somewhere in there. And me and a couple of buddies were, you know, having one of those, like, stay up late, play video games, sleep over, like, you know, go out and whatever we did, set fires in the woods or something. I don't know, we were real hooligans and, you know, tough. We were a gang, I think, or something, smash pumpkins, all that tough guy stuff. And so we decided tonight we're going to get drunk, you know, and we're going to drink. And I didn't know what to drink. I didn't know that much about it. I knew that my grandmother used to put cream de menthe on my vanilla ice cream sometimes when I was a kid, and I liked that a lot, and sometimes I'd just eat the cream de menthe off and hand her the ice cream back, you know, maybe that should have been the sign for me, but I don't know. I can't even imagine that being a good thing now. That's kind of turns my stomach now that I think about it, but anyway, so we decided to swipe some booze from my pop, and he drank, I knew he drank martinis, he drank vodka martinis, and
And so I knew not to take the vodka, because I'm sure, he knew how much vodka he had, you know, or vermouth or whatever else goes in that. And so we grabbed a bottle that I didn't think he'd miss, and he didn't. It was like one of those pocket rocket pint and a half of Everclear, you know, grain alcohol, good stuff. Not knowing anything about drinking, we didn't think of it to bring any ice or anything to mix it in or anything like that. We just, you know, walked down to the pier with a bottle of rubbing alcohol, basically, you know, and a really good plan. And you know, we had ate like three pizzas between three of us that earlier that night, and, you know, so it was messy, as you can imagine. But I remember about the third or fourth swig of that bottle that I could actually get down, and something happened. And I really, still to this day, can't really explain it. I all of a sudden, there was a guy, his name was Jeff. He was like the leader of the group, you know. He was like kind of the tough guy that was going to tell us what we were going to do. And me and this other guy, Jimmy, were like, okay, yeah, sure, let's do that. Let's break that guy's window. Yeah, okay, good. And he was the mastermind, I guess. And so I really just got this feeling that at some point in the evening, I don't know how many drinks I had, but that I had some really good things to say. You know, I had some good ideas, and they were going to be listened to, and they were going to be followed through with. And I don't know if they were or not, but I just remember that change. You know, we talk about the psychic change that occurs, you know, when we start doing the steps. And I remember that psychic change in my life of when I learned what alcohol did for me. I learned that I could have a little bit of this stuff and do what I wanted, you know. All of a sudden, people ought to be listening to me, I think. And, you know, I've got some good things to say. And that was really the beginning of, you know, my self-centered drinking rampage or whatever it was. I don't know what you want to call it. But really, for the next, I guess, 10 years, I did everything I could to stay drunk as I could. And you know, I obviously 13, I'm having trouble drinking every day. But getting it when I can. And you know, I got through high school without too much of a problem. I somehow made it into a college that even gave me some money to go there, which I think they regretted later on. They probably wanted it back, but they were stuck on that one. You know, I didn't realize how fortunate I was. I never had any idea of I was so selfish and self-centered that I thought that I was just owed this stuff. You know, I deserved to go away to college. I deserve to have you pay for it, you know. And I just felt like that it was my right somehow as a human being that you just leave me alone while I drink the way I want to drink. And, you know, you got a problem with my grades, that's your problem. You know, you got a problem with my drinking, that's your problem. And I muddled my way through it, and I was really constantly anxious. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. Dr. Silkworth sums it up perfectly for me. Me as an alcoholic. When I'm not drinking, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. And I can't figure out why I have to drink. Well, that's it. You know, because I can't stand myself not drinking. I can't stand anybody around me. And I hate the way I sound and the things I do and the way I look until I get that stuff. You know, that stuff. It was magical, man. It did everything. It was the most consistent friend I ever had. It did everything. It was perfect. It did everything I ever asked of it. And was always there, you know. If you had a couple bucks in your pocket, you were okay. Or, you know, if you had a friend who did, that worked out even better, you know. And so what happened was I got through this college somehow. I joined this fraternity, which, boy, that was really a wonderful bunch of guys that I've enjoyed getting to know now after college. You know what I mean? Like, I went to school with them for 4 years, and I'm like, oh, really? You're like that? That's what your parents are like? And all this, you know, it's just, all we did was drink together. Well, that's all I did. I mean, they may have spent more time than that, but I just got lost in this. I just stayed afloat. And I was always able to figure out some way to get another week on a paper, or, you know, a little push the deadline back a little bit, or maybe I could take a retest. You know, I was just always able to. I had some really good friends who were field hockey players that these girls had some good back tests. You know, like, I just had good solutions to my problem, which is, I don't want to work hard or study, but I need to stay in school because if I don't, I have to get a job and stop drinking so much, you know. And that's a dilemma for a guy like me, you know. What do I have to do to keep drinking? Those are the prices I have to pay. Oh, I got to, you know, try to work this over this way. And I don't know. It was just, I look back at it. I think I could have learned a lot more. But maybe I just learned the wrong things. Anyway. So I got finished. I got out of there somehow. And here I am. I cut my hair. It was down to here for a while, and I was here. We were talking before the meeting. I was going to go on this like 4-week long sailing trip with my buddy who lived on a boat in Florida. And we, you know, I had a really good plan together. I was going to take some time off, man, because I've been working hard, you know. And my dad has a. I was actually my grandfather's business, industrial type distributor, and they. And he started it in the 60s and passed it on to my dad, and you know, it was always kind of, I never felt forced into it, but it was always kind of an option if you want to work. It's hard work, but, you know, it's there if you want it, you know. I mean, what a privilege, you know. And I never looked at it that way. I was always like, yeah, great, you know, I got it. It was a summer job, and I hated it, you know. I was loading trucks in the back and just sweating and just hating it. I just, you know, I'd be hungover out making deliveries, and I'd pull up in the church parking lot a lot like this one, just sleep on the bench for a while. I never understood anything wrong with that, you know. Like, it was just, they're making me work through my summer vacation, you know. I deserve a rest, you know. And this is that's my mindset. I'm so selfish. And so, so, you know, my dad said, well, that sounds like a very good plan, son. Tell him about the sailing trip. You know, I said, that sounds very nice. If you want to work for us, I'll see you 8:00 Monday morning. He told me that graduation day. I said, oh, okay. So he kind of quotes my plans, and I showed up, and I did everything I could to not do that job for the next 2 years, and that was kind of the end of my drinking. I they moved me down to Richmond, Virginia, and I wasn't very good at my job. Now, that's an understatement. I took every advantage I could to try to not do that job while still getting paid for it. And you know, like, they gave me things like an expense account. I don't know what they were thinking there, you know, just things that alcoholics of my type should not have. You know, a vehicle? Like, no. That's not a good idea. So now I'm driving this company truck, like, the wrong way in the fan and, you know, wrong one-way roads and swerving back and forth and blowing through tolls and, you know, just, I was a mess. I was bouncing my car off of things, and I was pocket that they gave me a cell phone, and I would be out at the bar at like 3:00 in the morning, 2:30 in the morning on a school night, and you know, I'd be dialing customers in my pocket without knowing, you know, they're getting phone calls, and I get calls the next day, you know, and that's what would happen. I get calls the next day, what happened? Oh, I must have fallen asleep and rolled over, and they're like, oh yeah, was there a band playing in your room that night? You know, it's like, oh geez, okay, you caught me. Come on, relax, you know, and it was their fault. It was their fault. They shouldn't have worked me so hard. They should have given me that 4 weeks, you know, and then go sailing already. But anyway, getting hot in here. I'm just telling the truth. So, you know, 2 years of that, just taking every advantage I could of, you know, putting my dad in an awful situation because he's my employer, but he's my dad. You know, and his partner sitting there saying, well, what are we going to do with your jackass son? And you know, when's he going to wake up? You know, we can't keep paying him to do nothing. And you know, putting in false sales reports. And, you know, all that stuff that you hear about, like reading the book and stuff. Like, oh, my God, you know, the guy with the whiskey and the milk. And, you know, what a terrible salesman. You know, I never thought about it. Like, that's what I did, you know. Whiskey and milk, if that was all it was, are you kidding me, you know? So I get a phone call, and I had gotten into a lot of other stuff besides drinking, but, you know, whatever could get me out of my head. I'll just leave that at that. I like to stay up really late, and I had trouble drinking to a certain point in the evening without some help, and you know how that goes. But anyway, I have found that, you know, as a result of doing the steps, as a result of taking these actions, that all that other stuff's been removed too. And I don't know where it went. And I'm not looking for it, to be quite honest with you. If you find it, keep it. You know, really, it's not for me. I was laughing. I had lunch on the way down here to a Mexican restaurant, and it was my kind of place, man. They had 32-ounce Budweisers for $5 a piece, and I was like, man, this is, you know, who needs to eat? You know what I mean? Like, that's living right there. Just give me the biggest thing you got, you know, And so that's where I was. I was lost in Richmond. It's funny because we used to go. Most of you probably know Richmond okay. The bar section that we would go to was Chaco Slip and Chaco Bottom. And it took me a couple years sober to realize that a lot of those, the end of my drinking was at the Slip and the Bottom. I just thought that was kind of weird. I'm like, I didn't even know what those words meant, you know. And there I was just in a fog in the Slip and the Bottom, you know. And come on, let's go to the Bottom. I'm like, oh, I'm not there yet. Come on. So, you know, here I am in Richmond, and I get this phone call from my dad. Finally, you know, it was probably a year and a half overdue. I mean, I don't know why they put up with me. I hear people talk about I was unemployable and didn't have a job, and I was on the street. And I have no doubt in my mind that I was just about as unemployable as you can be. I mean, it was not. I don't think I could have washed dishes. You know, I just was a mess. And didn't care, and didn't feel like I should be accountable for that. I didn't see how it was any of my fault. I was just ignorant, you know, ignorant, selfish. And so I get this call, and it's my dad. He says to me, you know, I don't know what you're doing down there. I don't know if it's the drugs or the drinking or whatever, but something's wrong. And something's wrong with you. You know, he narrowed it down, so I didn't, you know, I was like, well, yeah, something's wrong with the company. Let me tell you how to fix it. And, you know, he's, something's wrong with you. And I'm calling you now not as your boss, but as your dad, because I'm worried about you and I don't know what to do. I want to help, but I don't know how. And he said, if you don't want to do this job, you know, if you think you could do something, if you want to go do something else, please do. You know, I don't feel like you owe it to me that you had to. But it seems to me that you're not doing it. He threw that in at the end, And I was like, oh, you know, cut a little bit. Because it was the first time I think he ever really sat down and told me the truth. He's a drinker. I mean, you know, it runs pretty thick in the blood. I don't know whether it's hereditary or genetic or, I don't really care. It doesn't matter. If I knew, it wouldn't help. You know what I mean? But I do know that we have a pattern. At least the men in our family. But so he says, he said, I don't know what to do, but, you know, if you can't do this job, I don't know what to do. You know, we can't put up with this anymore. And I broke down a little bit. And I did blame it on the drugs, of course, because I mean, I would have to stop drinking if I told him it was the alcohol. And you know, he said, we'll try to get you some help. You know, come on up and bring the, had to bring the company truck back up and park it in the parking lot. And, you know, like a little slow walk through my mom's car. And they were split up. And she was a big help. She moved me. I'd been kicked out of my place in Richmond. I was kind of living out of my car those last couple of days, and it was, you know, he kind of swooped in at the right time. I don't know how long I would have made it. I'm not real tough. I'm not a street drunk. I have no doubt in my mind that I could have adapted myself to be such, but at that point I didn't have any skills. I didn't know. My sponsor, if he was here, he'd tell you how he lived in his car for months, and, you know, it just, what did he do? He drove it between two trees. He was driving down the road, and it got stuck, and so he lived there. You know, he just moved in, and that's alcoholic thinking. You know, that's where that makes sense to me. When I heard that, I'm like, boy, I should have done that. You know, people wouldn't have been sending me those damn bills. You know, no address, right? But that's, you know, anyway, I ended up going to see a psychiatrist, which, you know, I thought would fix me. And I'd been to AA before. I mean, you know, you don't drink like I do and not go to AA at some point. I had to do something. I had to keep my license or stay out of jail or something. I don't remember. You know, I wasn't into it. I was 21 years old the first time I went to AA, and I was way too young to be an alcoholic. This is what 21-year-olds do, you know. It's cool. It's your problem. Adults, you know. And two years later, I'm, you know, in the exact same spot. And I'm like, this is what 23-year-olds do, you know. And like, how long are you going to keep saying that, you know. I couldn't see the truth from the false. Everybody who's had anything to do with me told me I had a drinking problem. I mean, everybody. Even the people I drank Jack Daniels with at 9 o'clock in the morning on the kitchen floor because we didn't have any furniture. You know, it was just that it made sense to us together. And then we, you know, halfway through the day, I'm still drinking, and they're passed out. And they're like, what's wrong with you? Why do you drink like that? I'm like, we were just doing shots of Jack Daniels at 9 in the morning. Come on, man. He's up. Well, it's fine. Go to sleep. I'll finish it. You know, it made sense. So everybody, my family, my girlfriends, and even my close friends would say, you have a drink? Why don't you stop drinking? Or moderate. Isn't it funny? How do you do that? I don't know. I knew that wasn't an option because I knew how I drank. I mean, I knew time and time again that the one thing I understood about AA or alcoholism, I guess I should say, AA didn't invent alcoholism. Thank God. Saved us from it. One thing I did know about that was that when I started drinking, I did not know when I was going to stop. And I knew that. I'd proven that to myself time and time again. And had no, made no bones about it, you know. So I would wake up in the morning and say, oh my God, I can't drink like that again tonight. Which meant, I can't drink tonight. Because when I drink like that. I know that. And so, you know, here I was, and I understand the phenomena of craving that Dr. Silkwood talks about. I understand that need for more, that when I start, I can't stop. I just don't know when. And that wouldn't be so bad if that's all it was, you know. It would be kind of boring, I think, because you would come to meetings and they'd say, just don't drink. You know, just don't drink. No matter what happens. If your butt falls off or whatever, don't drink. You know, and you've heard it. It's all, you know. But that's not it. Because I've not drank before. I've quit lots of times. And I've always found some ridiculous excuse to find myself at the same old smoky bar or at the same old package goods store, you know, 5 minutes before closing time or 5 minutes before opening time, you know what I mean, standing in the parking lot smoking cigarettes like this. I have no clue when I'm going to start drinking once I stop. And that's what I didn't understand about alcoholism. That's what I, in my 6 month plan, and when I thought I had it all figured out and I was going to prove to them that I was not an alcoholic, I had no idea what would happen to me if I went that long without drinking. I mean, I would wake up time after time, morning after morning, I can't drink like that again, can't drink like that again. And by 2 o'clock, I'd change my mind. What is that? You know, that's alcoholism. I mean, that's that peculiar mental twist that I have that says to me, you know what? Bob said he was going to meet you at the bar the other day, and if you're not there, he'll probably be upset with you, you know? And like, he might even buy you a drink if you go, ding, 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 you know? And like, all of a sudden, like, I want to make sure those guys know I got home okay last night. Or, you know, just whatever ridiculous reason that I would come up with to try to find some excuse. And man, I just had the worst night last night, and I thought I was going to die this morning. I wanted to die this morning. I was so sick. And yet, somehow, by 1:30, 2 o'clock, I'm like, I got a good idea. I got a good idea. I'm going to go down to the bar. The bartender that I like, she's working tonight. I'm going to go make sure she's pouring the drinks right, and everything will be fine. And it was. You know, they talk about. I don't know. I've been talking about the doctor's opinion a lot. I don't know why it's sticking in my head for some reason, but you know, he talks about that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once with that drink, that first drink. And man, I was like, oh. Because you wake up in the morning, you're like, oh God, I can't. You know, they're coming. Here they come. I don't know who they are, but they're coming and they're looking for something that's theirs. Oh God. Terror, bewilderment. So I'd race into that bar, man, like somebody was chasing me, and I'd sit down. And I know exactly what he's talking about, that sense of ease and comfort. That, I mean, sometimes I didn't even have to put it to my lips. Sometimes she'd just put the glass on the, you know, I went to this place that kept the glasses in the freezer. You know, it was a nice joint, you know, they had a freezer for the glasses. And, whatever that means. They didn't have any ice, but... And she'd put it there, and I'd watch, like, the little frost fog on top of it, and, you know, watch it freeze up while it's sitting there in the little thing for him. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I get these wistful eyes, and it was almost like she'd set it down in front of me, and I get that sense of easy comfort, because I knew that's where it was. I knew the answer was very close and coming to me quick. And
And like I said, it worked. It worked for every problem I had. It worked for every person in my life. I could drink at you like it was my second job. And what happened? It stopped working. What a tragedy. All of a sudden, I'm in this spot where I can't imagine drinking. You know, the book calls it the jumping off point. I can't imagine going on another day without drinking. And I can't imagine going on another day drinking. Can't imagine life without alcohol. And if you're an alcoholic like me, that's a really scary place to be because there's nowhere to go. Fortunately for us, it's also like the best beginning there is in this journey at Alcoholics Anonymous, at least in my experience. I mean, I'm sure there's other ways to get to it, but like I said, I tried everything. I went to AA before, did the outpatient thing. Now I'm in an inpatient. You know, that was their solution, that they didn't know what to do with me. They gave me medical leave of absence. I'm telling you, these people were, you know, more loving and tolerant than I'll ever know. You know, these people that I worked for and my family and sent me away to just the best rehab they could find. And I got this book. It's from right here. And a $20,000 debt. This is a good book. It gets better every time I read it. I'm like, okay, this is going to be the, you know, 4,200. Never mind. It doesn't matter. And I don't have any real opinion on that. I had to go there. I had to. Because until I did, it was a solution in my mind for my alcoholism. And God bless them, they gave me some good food and a nice place to sleep. And they cut through my crap. They gave me an alcoholic, they call her a counselor. She was the closest thing I had had to a sponsor up until that point in my life. She was a tough Texan, real burly woman. You know, she would say things like, "This is where the rubber meets the road," you know. I'm like, "Oh, okay, you know, get away from me." And she did things. She had me write inventories. I mean, they were first step inventories or whatever, you know, whatever they wanted to call them. But she had me writing. She had me moving my feet. She had me working on something. And most of the stuff that I found wasn't, you know. Okay, that's enough of that. I'm not going there. Anyway, it was exactly what I needed at the time because up until then it was a solution. It was an alternative to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'd been to AA. And one thing I knew about you people is you didn't drink. And you didn't drink like a lot, like all the time. You didn't drink for a long time. And I was like, man, I got 6 months is all I got to hang on here. You know, if I start going to AA, it'll suck me right into their cult. And I was worried about that. And so I started going to AA meetings because they made us at this place. They had two vans. It was a nice place. They had two vans. And one went to NA, one went to AA. The druggy buggy and the alcoholer. They went two different directions. And I always wanted to get on the druggy buggy, and they always turned me around. Oh, you go this way, son. And I'm like, oh, all right. They don't understand my problem, you know. And they did. They were all alcoholics, all the counselors. Everybody who worked there was like an alumnus of the program. It was kind of cool. But, like, again, when, you know, my 28 days was up and my insurance said, we're not paying for them anymore, you know. It's one of those, like, when you're at the bar, it's like, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here kind of deals. And they gave me meetings, and they gave me this book, and they gave me the best directions they could, which was go to meetings and get a sponsor. And you know, I had heard those directions before. I heard them in AA. And I was kind of like frustrated because I was saying, that's all you got? You know, like, come on, I need like a better, like a relapse prevention program or something. You know, I need something good. And they said, yeah, go to meetings, get a home group, get a job, and get a sponsor and do the steps. I'm like, oh, no, I'm not doing all that. And I'm still working on my 6 month plan. I went away for all this because the problem was obviously an East Coast problem. It was Philadelphia, Richmond, Baltimore. Those were the problems, you know. So I go away, and I'm doing good. 4 months. I went to a halfway house after that. And, you know, this whole time I'm trying to keep my license, stay out of jail, all that stuff is
the legal stuff, you know, I'm talking about the head stuff. The legal stuff's going on too, and I'm sure you guys know what all that is. So I get back, and I don't have anywhere to go. Except my dad's house. My boss's house. Same guy. And he lived there with my grandfather, my stepmother, and him in this house. It was actually my grandfather's house. They moved in to take care of me, went blind, and couldn't get around too well. Excuse me. And they all drank every day. You know, my grandfather was 85 years old, and he was amazing. He would wait until 5 o'clock, and he had his watch set. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, this is geared up, and it would beep, 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 you know, it would go off. It even talked to him, it was like 5 p.m., and he'd be like, woohoo, and he'd go over, and he'd pour himself a drink, and he couldn't see, so he'd stick his finger in the glass, and he'd pour it up until it hit his finger, and then top it off with water. It's vodka and water. It's his drink. And God bless him, you know, and that damn bottle, he drank like Pop-Off or something, Smirnoff. It was terrible, whatever, it was a plastic bottle, and he'd pull the cap off of it. And it would sit there on the counter, you know. And by this point, I realized that, you know, I have a drinking problem, you know, and I've hung out with all these people 28 days, not 4 months, and the halfway house was all men, and we were, you know, it was like 40 men in like this weird, like, converted convalescence home. It was a strange place to be, man. We 25 people in a room all talking about the steps that they haven't done yet, you know, but they were thinking about, and, you know, we were just getting stir crazy, you know. The only thing that got me through was a couple of the guys worked at a golf course who could get us on for free at twilight, you know. I was like, okay, that's pretty good, man. But, I left that place, and I had a counselor there too, and I told him straight up, I said, I'm afraid to go home because I don't want to drink. And that puts a guy like me in a good spot, because I finally have the requirement for membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. Finally. And it took me long enough. I finally don't want to drink. And I don't know how to do it. I don't have the slightest clue how to live without a drink. And so they gave me, you know, they said, well, before you go back, call your area, find some meetings, you know, go to a meeting that night that you get off the plane. And so I did. And I went to a meeting in Annapolis, and I met a couple of guys, and one of them was one of those weirdos, one of those happy sober guys. And I'm like, eh, you know, I didn't really like the idea of hanging out with him too much, but the alternative was, you know, being miserable alone in my room. So we went out and had a cup of coffee, and he started doing what we do. He started telling me about him. He started telling me about Bill and Bob and kind of the beginning of AA and you know, what this is about. And you know, he said, this is nice. The coffee's nice. You know, it's nice to have a job and a service position and all that stuff. And the fellowship's nice. But the core of this program is one-on-one. Is this right here. One alcoholic talking to another for the sole purpose of recovery. I mean, not getting paid or, you know, getting any kudos or whatever, you know. There was no glory in it in my mind. I'm sitting here like, well, what do you do that for? You know, it just didn't seem to make any sense. You go out of your way to talk to a guy, you know, I don't really want to listen to you. I don't think you want to talk to me all that much. What are we doing here? And it somehow, so I was like relaxing inside. I could feel myself, could feel my head get quiet. Because up until that point, I was going home, zooming home from the meeting, and it was almost like my brain turned on when the light turned off. You know, like I get into bed and I'm ready to sleep, and that's like, what are you going to do tomorrow? And like, what if he says this? Well, you got to say this. You know, what if they found out about that? And, you know, it was just this constant, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to me? This is like a broken record, man. It was insane. You know, I couldn't stand it. And I didn't know how to get rid of it. And that's, for me, that's what the mental obsession. That's my problem. Restless, irritable, and discontent. If I'm not drunk and not in the solution, a spiritual way of life, then that's what I do. And I still do it. And I still get goofy and I have doubt and I sit there and freak out about imaginary circumstances, you know, things that may or may not happen, and I lose myself in it, you know. It's better than it was, thank God. But they did. They talked about God. They talked about spiritual solution. I was like, that's all you got? They said, well, you can have an alcoholic death. And I was like, oh, how long does that take? You know, just got that mental thinking, you know, that peculiar mental twist of alcoholic death. Man, you know, is that like a cool, like, fiery crash, like jumping off a bridge, or is that like, you know, like liver failure and you know, like, you know, like turning gray and that kind of stuff? I wanted like a glorious, you know, out with a bang kind of death. I didn't want to die alone in a room and have somebody find me 4 days later. And unfortunately, it happens. Well, it happens both ways, but those are our options. If you're an alcoholic like me, that's it. Lovely. And like I said, that's at the time, it was the worst place in the world for me to be. That desperation was made me sick. I felt like it was, like I wanted to die. Like it was just the worst place I could have ever been. And the more I look at it, the farther away from it I get, I realize it was it was a gift from God. I have no doubt about that. It was the best place I ever could have been. It was the only place that I could have shut up long enough to hear a message of hope. You know, I don't like to do that. I like to talk over you. I'm in a family where, like, the loudest one wins, you know, and that was a new idea for me. And so these people grabbed me, and they threw me in the back of a car, and they drive me around to meetings in Delaware and Pennsylvania, and Baltimore and Annapolis and Richmond and, you know, and Madison and wherever we went. You know, I'm just like, guys, have we ever stopped driving? You know, we're just all over the place. And you know, if you told me you had a cake party going on in Charlottesville tonight, I'd be there in a heartbeat, you know. But a meeting? You know, come on. It's like, come on. So I would sit in the car, and these people were showing me how to recover. And they were showing me how to live sober, and that's all I wanted to know how to do. But I was too busy in here to see it. You know, they're talking back and forth about steps and recovery, 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 God, 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 back and forth in front of my nose, and I'm going, Adam, 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 you know, like trying to, I don't want to. Me, 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 me. Because I was still just as selfish and self-centered as ever, now I just wasn't drunk, so I didn't know as much all of a sudden. Wow, that's not true either, but anyway. And so I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he agreed. I had been sober longer than him, as a matter of fact. So, there's something for you. You know? Think you can't sponsor somebody because you're not through the steps? Or, oh. He's not my sponsor now. I have another sponsor. But that's okay, too. He sponsored me really well for a year and a half, and we're both still sober, and I couldn't hear 23 years. I couldn't hear 10 years. It just didn't make any sense to me. And here was a guy who I had been sober like a month longer than, who was putting it together, you know, who was seemed like he was happy, joyous, and free. And I'm like pissed off and miserable, you know, and I'm like, what are you doing, you know, because like I know it's not just time away from a drink, things I have to do. And he showed me, and we started doing the steps and started asking questions like that of, you know, I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And I didn't know how to do that. He said, when you drink, do you always know when you're going to stop? And I said, no. He said, when you stop drinking, do you always know when you're going to start again? I said, no. And he said, sounds to me like you may be powerless over alcohol. What? You're powerless over alcohol? Come on, that little drink. Because I never understood that, like, that's what my problem was. When I wasn't drunk, I was thinking about it. And when I was, you know, I was restless, irritable, discontent. Until I got that stuff, couldn't be comfortable. So he said, well, there's your options. And he gave me those options. Spiritual way of life, or the other one. And he said, all you got to do is follow us, do what we do. If you want what somebody else has, do what he does. You know, try it out. See what, you know. See what happens. And you might be surprised. And I was. And so we got down on my knees, I don't know, maybe the second week. I'm cruising around with this crew. And I said my third step prayer. And he reminded me how small I was. And that, not in a diminutive way. Not in a nasty, like condescending way. He said, Adam, He said, you have to have a bigger God than the pile of shit that you have. He said, if you have a 6-foot pile and a 3-foot God, you're in a lot of trouble. He said, you know, try to imagine a spirit of the universe. Try to imagine whatever it is for you. And he left the door open. You know, he said, that you can get, why don't you come up with your own? You know, you're asking a sick, crazy alcoholic with a 6-month plan to conceive God. And I said, I can't take the third step prayer. I don't understand who God is. And he said, you don't have to understand. You just have to do the prayer. You know, it doesn't matter. Just relax. It's a big deal. I didn't realize that there was nothing to know here. There's nothing to figure out. That, you know, the problem had been solved long before I came along. And that it continues to be solved, you know, with or without my help. And that I was just a tool. I was always a tool. And that doesn't sound right. Wait a second, let me rephrase that. But, you know, at some point in my life, God was always either using me as an example of what to do or what not to do. You know, and most of my life it was what not to do. And I got the results. You know, I was in jail, and I was in legal problems, and I was in flunking out of school, and I was, you know, like a failure as a son and an employee, and, you know, all that stuff. I was showing people, don't do this, because this is what I got. You don't want that. And here were people in AA showing me that, you know, the reason we're happy is because we do this. Now, you're welcome to do whatever you like. They never tried to convince me to stop drinking. In fact, they said, if you feel like you may not be an alcoholic, we suggest you try some controlled drinking. What's that? I never heard of it before, you know? Like, you mean like some of this and some of that? Or, you know, like, I don't understand. And they said, no, well, you know, George said, somebody told him when he was up in Pennsylvania to get a 12-pack of Budweiser and for the next 12 nights come home and have one Budweiser. He said that, and I laughed at him. And he said, yeah, you may be an alcoholic. And so there I am. I'm doing this third step prayer, you know, and I'm offering myself to this God that I don't know and don't understand and don't think has anything to do with me. And what's the point? And that's another good spot for me to be. Because without that, I'm not going to take a leap of faith. I'm not going to write the four-step inventory because I don't trust. I'm so afraid that somebody's going to get a hold of this thing, you know, and give it to the press. You know, like anybody cares about my crap, you know. And then I come to find out after doing it all that you all did the exact same stuff I did, you know. And here I am hiding it from you, and then I get finished, and they're like, oh, good, you know, finally you wake up, you know. And that's what I did. I wrote all that stuff. You know, the stuff that I drank over, all the fear and the resentment. The resentment part was actually kind of fun. All those people you hate, you get to scratch the name real hard into the paper, you know, and like, dot the I's like a stabbing motion. And sick, man. And so I got it now. I got this list, and I'm holding it up. Hey, I got the list. You know, I did my 4-step. And they said, oh, good for you. You know, I'll meet you next week to do it. I'm like, no, I want to do it now. You know, I start pouting, and he's laughing at me, and just whining all the time. And so we sat down, and I did my 5th step, and I heard a guy say it better than I can, so I'll just steal it from him. It seems to me that that point in my life, that 5th step, that the just the action of taking it, I draw the line in being dry and being recovered. Or recovering, whatever you want to call it. Because up until that point, all that stuff's still in here, dancing around. And up until I take that step, I don't feel connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it's nice and all. You know, you got free coffee, and, you know, we can all BS about baseball or politics or whatever. It's not going to keep me sober. But until I get that stuff out, it's still going to haunt me. And most of it's not a big deal. you know, most of the resentment, it's wild because, you know, jumping ahead just a second, I made some of those amends, like the people don't even remember who I am, you know, and that, you know, we would talk about like deflation of ego. I'm like, what do you mean you don't remember me? You know, I wronged you, you know, it's just like, who the hell are you again? Get out of here, yeah. Not as big as I thought I was. And, but I did that fifth step, and man, like, just talk about an eye opener. That all this awful stuff that I thought I did, I was going to take to my grave. I mean, even the really bad stuff. And my sponsor had done it all. You know, brought most of it better than I did. And he said, he didn't say I was wrong, or didn't say that was this or that. He just, he said, this is what I did. And it's never stood between me and God. Ever since I let it out, ever since I started taking these actions, it hasn't blocked me off like it had in the past. And that's what I did. And like I said, I it changed my life. I didn't want to do it. I kind of went into it kicking and screaming. And after doing it, I felt, well, the book says it better than I can. I felt like I was walking hand in hand with my Creator. You know, down the broad highway of life. What's it say? God, it's beautiful. Our fears fall from us. That's it. What an understatement. Our fears fall from us. That's so beautiful. Because up until that point in my life, my world ran on fear. And the only reason I ever did anything was because I thought somebody was going to find out that I was covering up some kind of track, or, you know, if I didn't do this, she wouldn't like me, or whatever. Just, it was just all this fear, anxiety. I felt it wasn't enough. I was never enough. Until I got to drinking, and then I was more than enough, you know what I mean? But without alcohol, I was full of fear. And I think, I assume that's why I drank. And so I write this stuff down, and if they fall from me, I mean, are you kidding me? I don't have to bury them or talk at them or anything. I just share them. Get them out in the sunlight, and they shrivel up. And he said, welcome to AA. I was like, man, I've been coming to meetings for it. He's like, man, I just go home and read these pages, you know. And he gave me the 6 or 7 steps. So I went home and took a nap and forgot about what he told me to do. And I did. I called him up 2 days later. I said, what were those pages again? He said, whatever, it was 64 or something. I forget. I'm terrible with page numbers. And I read it, and I called him back. I'm like, that's the 6 and 7 step. He's like, duh. You know, why'd you think I told you to do it? And he said, go ahead and do what it says. I said, I can't do it now. I'm at a restaurant. He said, God's in the restaurant, too. I'm like, oh. But I didn't. I balked again. I've never met anybody. Well, I'm sure there are other people, but I'm not. But most people don't balk on 6 and 7. You know, those are kind of easy ones. They're like softballs. And I'm like, no, I got to think about this one, you know. And anyway, and so I find the exact natures of my wrongs, and I ask God to remove them, and the ones that He sees fit to make me more useful to Him, you know, because I thought it was all about me being a better person, so that my family thinks I'm a better guy, and that, you know, some people say they don't really want their money back. You know, I thought there was a real plan here, that, you know, like, go back to the judge and say, see, I did my fifth step, you know. He's like, what's a fifth step? And so that's what it says, 7-step prayer, you know. All those defects of character which stand in my way to you. How can I be more useful to you? And we get the answer. We write an 8-step. And I didn't really want to do that either. And he said, don't worry, you don't have to. You already have it. It's your 4-step list. And he added a couple names, of course. And took off the ones that I really wanted to do, you know, all the ex-girlfriends and stuff that I was... really had to amend, and quick, you know, before they went away, you know. There was one who was going to overseas for a semester, and I'm like, I got to do her first, you know. He's like, whoa, he's that partner, you know. He said, why don't you just wait a while and work with your grandfather first. And I always feel like I have to... I couldn't understand what was keeping me in AA. I knew there was something here. I didn't know what to call it. We call it hope, and that's nice, and it is. And magic. You know, it almost seemed more like magic to me. like these lives that were just a total mess, like rebirth, like the phoenix, you know, they just take off in a new direction. You know, I didn't get my old life back. Thank God. I didn't want my old life back. I was trying to kill myself. You know what I mean? That didn't make any sense to try to get my old life back. Magic. And so I sat down with my grandfather, and he drank every day, and I really was sure that I was going to try to get him help. You know, I wanted to help him because I thought that he was sick. He was dying, and he was really drunk. And I had every good intention to try to make AA available to him. And he was 85, 86 years old. And I was going to, you know, grab him and throw him in a wheelchair and wheel him into a meeting and, you know, like throw a big book at him and be like, here, you know, get it on tape so he could listen to it. You know, I just had this really good plan of saving my pop. And the sponsor laughed at me. He said, why don't you go make amends and give him the money you own and tell him how you wronged him and tell him how... if you keep doing what you're doing, you don't ever have to be that person again. And I said, yeah, and then I'll get to tell him about God, you know. And I went to tell him, you know, I told him all the stuff, you know, made amends, and then went to tell him about all the stuff I learned about God and spirituality and how wonderful life was. And he started telling me about his God and his relationship to his church. And I didn't know he really had that kind of thing. When he was a kid, he really was devout, and he was an altar boy. And, you know, he just really had this really wonderful relationship with God I never had knew he had. And he was talking, and I'm sitting here saying, okay, Pop, now I want to tell you about my stuff, you know, and went to, he finally got finished, finally shut up, and I went to tell him, okay, you know, here comes the AA God, you know, here we go, ready? And he fell asleep. Right there in the chair. And I'm like, oh. But you know what's amazing is that I didn't know what to do with him. I just tried to be the best grandson I could, you know. And when he would make a mess of himself, I'd clean him up, and when he fell down, I'd pick him up and just do whatever I could. I mean, I'm sure any one of you have done the same thing, but I got this opportunity, and I have no doubt that it was a direct result of the next step. He had a stroke. Christmas Day, maybe it was Christmas Eve, but he was really feeling the effects of it Christmas Day. And I had been sober about a year and a half, so it was 2003. And 2004. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Sorry. He was really out of it. And my sister's family was in town and everything, and there was a lot of commotion going on, and my dad was going to take everybody out to the movies on Christmas Day. We always go to the movies. I don't know why. It's like, whatever. That's what we do. And some people go to church. We go to the movies. and they you know, they were going to leave him there because he wasn't feeling good. And he was just out of it. And I got this feeling that I needed to stay there, and I did. And he was having trouble putting sentences together. You know, he was like, he couldn't. He kept trying to ask me questions about. That, you know, he's like, well, tell me how it's going with, and then he just lose the word, and he couldn't figure it. You know, he was just like, he was almost there, and you're like, oh. And I was like, it's okay, Pop. You don't have to talk. You know, I'll just sit here with you. And I said, how about you want to sing? He was a really good singer, a great voice. He was a barbershop quartet, you know, back in the 60s. And beautiful voice. And he smoked for 60 years, and he had a great voice. Couldn't figure that out. And so we started singing Christmas carols. And he remembered every word and sang it, I mean, every note. And just, you know, we started saying everyone we knew. Someone we sang twice, you know, and it was just the most incredible thing that's ever happened to me, I think. That he could see him let go. Now, something else happened while we're singing these Christmas carols and, you know, kind of by ourselves in this house. I realized that, you know, here's a guy who drinks every day at 5 o'clock. I told you, he sets his watch by it, right? And he hadn't had a drink in 2 days, and he's diabetic. And I was just—he was shaking, and he was, you know, thinking he saw things that weren't there, kind of going through like delirium a little bit. And I didn't know if it was a stroke or DTs or what. But I said, "Pop, how would you like a drink?" And he couldn't answer. You know, he just had this kind of blank stare. Like he wanted to say yes, but he knew that I was in AA and that I wasn't drinking. He just didn't feel comfortable asking me.
And I said, it's okay, Papa. Put my hand on his shoulder and went and poured him a drink and brought it to him. Mixed a little sugar in it, tried to boost him up a little bit, you know, and I helped him get a couple sips down. And you know, I know what that sense of ease and comfort means in here, because I felt it many times. You know, when everything's coming down around you and you get that drink, you're like, oh. But I had never seen it just like that, right in front of me, happened right in front of me like that, like instantly. I mean, his shoulders dropped, a little half smile came over his face, and like all he wanted in the world was that drink, and he couldn't ask anybody, you know, and it was just, here I was trying to save this guy, and all I wanted to do was get him to stop drinking. You know, come on, Papa, I'm going to save you. And he had a couple of drinks, and he relaxed, finally relaxed. And he wanted to lay down, and we couldn't make it to the bed, so we just laid down on the floor in his bedroom, and I laid down there with him, and they had this little, still have him, a little Westie, you know, like a white Toto, little tiny puppy, you know. And usually he's a maniac, jumping all over you and everything, and this time he just laid down right between us. It was really weird. And we laid down, and he fell asleep, and before he fell asleep, he said he could see my grandmother, who had been dead for about 5 years. And it was Thursday night. My folks came home from the movies, and I told him that he was asleep on the floor, and he was doing okay, and, you know, we should probably just leave him alone a little bit. And I went to my home group, 8:30, and came back about 10, and he was gone. I mean, he'd never moved from where he was. And so when I talk about amends, I always think of, like, how I think they should go. You know, how I'm going to help somebody after wronging them for all these years and what I think they need, what I think I need to do to fix the relationship. And really the truth is that, at least as I see it, I can't tell you what the truth is that God alone knows what's best for my pop. God alone knows what's best for me, knows what's best for you, and all those people on my list. And as much as I sit there and try to figure out what I need to do for them, they're going to tell me, you know, most of them. And whenever they don't tell me, God will somehow. And it wasn't until after I fed him that drink and set it down, I never even once thought, never once, to take a sip of it. Now, that's not me. I don't know where that comes from, but it's not me. It's got to be bigger than me. Because if that's me, I'm, you know, drinking three of them and then bringing you one. Like, hey, what a great guy I am, you know. I just drank half your bottle of booze, you know. But, you know, I never saw. He was so afraid. And then he had a drink. And he relaxed and died. And I'll never be able to fully realize, I don't think, how much that means to him or my grandmother, who I'm sure was really there if he saw her. And it just always reminds me of what I think I need to do for other people. And, you know, maybe what's really in store is not always the same thing. So, anyway, thanks you guys for having me. And it was a pleasure coming down here. Thanks.